The Torah starts with a discussion, a narrative of the creation of the world in 6 days. And there are those that have a problem with that parsha of the Torah, the parsha of creation, because scientifically it seems that the world is much older than 6 days plus 5,766 years. And we're not talking about, you know, plus or minus a few years here and there. We're talking about millions and billions of years. The world is 3 billion years old or more, who knows what else. It's a far cry from 5,766. And there are various ways of resolving the seeming conflict between science and Torah. Amongst them, I'll mention them quickly. I don't want to go into great detail because that's not the intent of what I plan to tell you. But there are ways of resolving this seeming conflict. One, the Tiferes Yisrael says that God created originally something from nothing, the original creation, and then he went on to create worlds and destroy worlds and create worlds and destroy worlds, and our world was not the first created world. And therefore the things that we find and the evidence we find of things being ancient and the fossils and things like that are remnants of earlier worlds that were created and destroyed. One possibility. Another possibility, some say that when the Torah speaks about 6 days of creation, they weren't days from a human standpoint, but God's days. And in Tehillim it says, Elef shonim be'enecha kiyom esmol, 1,000 years in your eyes is like a day past. And therefore it's possible that from God's standpoint, a day meant millions of years or more. Even though it says 1,000 years, but that doesn't necessarily mean specifically. It means that to God, what's the difference between 1,000 years and a day? So when God speaks about 6 days, it means 6 epochs, and it could be much more than a 24-hour day. That's another possibility. Another possibility is that all of these don't answer all of the questions. Some answer some answer others. A combination of them answers all of them. But there's one interesting idea. In fact, I will quote Phil Chernofsky in the example I'm going to give you, because I heard it from him, and it's a very fine example. But let me tell you first what they say. And that is the following. Part of the problem is that we find many things that we can show that the age of them is much greater than 5,766 years. Rocks. They analyze the rocks and they can tell that they are millions of years old. They could think they brought the moon rocks back and analyze them. They can analyze carbon dating, right? And see that things are 10,000 years old, 20,000 years old, or whatever, living things. And inanimate things, they use potassium argon dating. I'll discuss in a second how that works, what it's all about in a second. And that also tells us that things are millions of years old. How do they know this? It doesn't come with a little tag on it that says when it was or whatever, how many years ago. So the way is the following. It's all basically the same system, just using different things. For living things, every living thing contains carbon. And as it lives and breathes, it adds to that carbon. And as soon as it dies, it starts to decay and decompose. Carbon has two isotopes. Regular carbon, which is carbon-12, has 12 the building blocks of the atom, right? Its atomic number is 12. And then there's an isotope of carbon, carbon-14, which has 2 extra electrons, which makes it radioactive. Radioactive carbon. Radioactive things are not stable, and they seek to stabilize themselves by giving off those extra electrons. and eventually the atom returns to be regular carbon, carbon 12. So carbon 14 changes into carbon 12 over a certain amount of time. The amount of time it takes for half of the atoms present in a substance to turn from carbon 14 to carbon 12 is called the half-life of that radioactive portion of that thing, and they know pretty much how long it takes. So therefore, if you know how much carbon 14 was in a thing, or basically you have an idea that an animal has in it X amount of carbon 14 when it dies, and you find today Y amount of carbon 14 less, so you know that the carbon 14 that was there, a portion of it changed to carbon 12. You know how long it takes for carbon 14 to change to carbon 12, and therefore the thing must be at least that old. That's how long it's been dead. So if it takes 10,000 years for half of the atoms to change from carbon 14 to carbon 12, and you find only half of what the normal atoms of carbon 14 in that thing, you knew that it took 10,000 years for that amount to change. Similarly, by things that are not alive, they use a different system, but it's basically the same thing. That's called potassium argon. Potassium also has isotopes of it that are radioactive, and they, after a time, change to the inert gas called argon. Gives off its electrons and turns into a different material, the periodic table of elements, a different element, turns into a different element. And the stable gases, argon is one of the stable gases, and that's what potassium changes into, and that takes millions of years for those atoms to change. And therefore, if they find a rock and it has a certain ratio between potassium and argon, and they know that the ratio originally was potassium and no argon because the argon came from the potassium, so then they can figure out how much of the percentage of the atoms changed from potassium to argon. They know how long that takes. And they can figure out how old the rock is. That's how things are dated. In any case, first of all, from a scientific standpoint, that is not an absolute thing. It depends on a lot of assumptions. It depends on the assumption, first of all, that the rate of decay of these things was constant. And that's been proven that it's not the case. Also, it also assumes that the amount of potassium or whatever that existed 5,000 years ago at the time of creation is the same amount that exists today in something or whatever. And that also is not necessarily the case. And if there was a different amount to begin with, you don't know how much changed. But there's something more significant that makes all of this irrelevant to a certain degree. And that's the following. This assumes that there was no creation, that God didn't create the world, the world evolved. So everything started out with potassium, and argon came from the breakdown of potassium. That's true. If it would have taken, right, if all the argon that's found only came from the breakdown of potassium, then if you have a certain amount of argon, it must have taken that much long to evolve, and therefore it must be that much that old. But that's not the way we believe. We believe that God created the world. And he created the world mature. He didn't create the world that happened to evolve. He created it mature. Let's take the first man. The first man, right, who changed Adam Harishon's diapers? He didn't have any diapers. You know why? Because he was created 20 years old. When he was created, he was a 20-year-old man. Now, if you went back to the sixth day of creation, took a scientist back to the sixth day of creation, God just created man. And man is a fully grown 20-year-old specimen. And you took the scientist and you said, examine this human being and tell me how old he is. So what would he say? He's 20 years old. Count his teeth, look at his skin, Look at his height, right? He's 20 years old, but he's not 20 years old. He's only a few hours old, right? Why? Because he was created 20 years old. That means when God created the world, he created it with potassium and with argon. It didn't have to take millions of years for all the argon to develop from potassium. God created the world with potassium and with argon. True, had it had to happen in a natural process, right, it would have taken millions of years. But God created it mature, just like he created man mature. So just like a scientist would say, on the sixth day of creation, it must be 20 years old minimum, because you couldn't have a man this size, this mature, in 6 hours. He must be 20 years, but it wasn't 20 years, because God created it that way. Similarly, everything else, all the other processes were created as a mature world, and therefore it didn't have to take millions and billions of years to reach that mature point that it would have had to take had it just evolved from scratch. The example that Phil Chernofsky gave, I heard it once on a tape from him, which I think is excellent, is the following. Forget about CDs, and let's just talk about tape recorders, okay? They still could handle that. I'm not holding by phonograph records, but let's talk about tape recorders. If you have a tape with music on it, and there are 10 songs on the tape, and each one takes 3 minutes, okay? And you know that the seventh song is Matovu. Okay, let's just for argument's sake. The seventh song is Matovu. You walk into a room and you hear them playing the seventh song, Matovu. Now, can you assume that they've been listening to that tape for 21 minutes? Because
no.
There are 3 minutes per song. This is the seventh song. The tape must have been playing for 21 minutes, right or wrong? Why can't you assume that? Right, because they could have pushed fast forward. And therefore, the tape may be playing for 3 seconds, but there's a fast forward button that makes it go to tape to song number 7. Mamela, true, if the world would have developed naturally without creation, then if we see, the things we see would have taken millions of years to develop. But God has a fast forward button. He created the world mature. And therefore it didn't have to take all that time to get to song number 7. He started with song number 7. So that's another way of understanding. Another way they say is based on the theory of relativity, which I'm not going to explain to you since I don't have too much of a clue what to explain. But basically the theory of relativity boiled down to what I can understand is that time is relative. It is not absolute. And therefore, time differs from different observers. How one person sees something, right, is different than another person sees it, and the time passage for a person at one point of observation is different than the time elapsed at another one. If you're going at the speed of light, time goes slower. Slower speeds, time goes faster. Therefore, there are those that say that from God's standpoint, right, where he is, right, in his world, time, goes very, very fast. And therefore, what for God is 6 days, for human beings is millions and millions of years. It's the same exact time. But in God's time relationship, it's 6 days. From how we, from our observation point on Earth, see it, millions and millions of years had to pass by. And according to the theory of relativity, that is very possible. Okay, to explain it to you, I can't, but that's an idea also of how this works. And therefore, hold on, and therefore, if it bothers you, the conflict from what science seems to say and what the Torah seems to say, so there are ways of resolving it. However, the truth is that that's not really the question. How could the Torah say God created the world in 6 days when it seems to be so much older and took so much more time to develop? I'll tell you what the rabbis ask. The rabbis ask the following question. The world was created with 10 ma'amoros, with 10 utterances. Okay, God created the world with 10 utterances. Just substitute that for 6 days. 10 utterances. And the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, the kol kach lama, why so many? Why did God need 10 utterances to create the world? God could have done it in one. He didn't need 10. But there's a lesson to teach me. Meaning, we can translate that into other terms. God created the world in 6 days. Why did he need 6 days? Why wasn't a fraction of a second, or even less than that, necessary? God needed 6 days to create the world. He couldn't do it in a microsecond. So the question isn't really, how could it take so short, right, when it seems to have been so long? The question is, why did it take so long of 6 days when it could have taken even less? But the truth is, even that's not relevant, because the Torah is not a science book. The Torah is not a history book. The Torah, the intent of the Torah and what is contained in the Torah is not science, it's not history, and therefore these questions don't even start. In fact, the Avos Rav Nosson poses that question that our Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says a little bit differently. In Avos Rav Nosson, the question is not, how come God had to create the world in 10 utterances when he could have done it in one? The question is a different question altogether. And that is, v'chimat tzorech l'boi olam b'kach. Who cares how many utterances God created the world in? For all I care, it could have been one. Why does the Torah tell us it was 10? That's the question. Why? Because the Torah is not a handbook on how to create worlds, right? That God gave us, and he said, next time you create some worlds, do it in 10 utterances. I'm teaching you how to create the world. We are not creators. We are created beings. We came into this world. We didn't create it, and we're not creating other worlds. Why do human beings who came into this world need to know that? What do you mean, why do we need to know that? It's interesting. If you ever have a trivia game, they ask you how many utterances God created the world, you'll know the answer. Isn't it interesting to know how many utterances God needed to create the world? The answer is, yeah, maybe interesting, but that's not what Torah is all about. Torah is not information. Torah is not history. It's not science. It is that which can transform you and make you a better person, closer to God, to give you Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, fear of God and what's it called, and love of God. That's what the purpose of Torah means, Horah. Torah means to teach, to guide. It's not just to give you information. There is nothing in the Torah that is there just for information. Reb Yecheskel Avramsky Zatzal explains the second to the last pasuk in Megillas Esther in the following way. The pasuk says, "V'chol maasei sokpo v'uraso u'parashas gedulas Mordechai halohen k'suvim al sefer divrei hayomim l'malchei modei u'foras." That the, all of the great acts of Mordechai and all of the incidents of his life are recorded in the history books of the kings of Persia and Moda. So Cheskel Avramsky says, what is this footnote to Megillas Esther? If you're interested in knowing more about Mordechai, right, here is a footnote, a maramakom, right, why don't you check the history books of Persia and Moda? Who ever checked them? Were they available? They weren't the library books in the public library. They were the books of the kings of Persia and Moda. They weren't available to anyone. So why does the Megillah feel it necessary, right, if you're interested in more information about Mordechai, check the history books? Says Rabbi Cheskel Avramsky, the Megillah is making the following point. If you're interested in learning the history of this period, the history of Mordechai HaYehudi, this is not the place to find it. This is not a history book. This is Megillas Esther. You want to know more about Mordechai historically, you have to look somewhere else. Megillas Esther is not a history book. It covers a period in Persian history, but it skips. There's so many gaps. A little bit from the first year, the third year, the ninth year, the seventh year, the 12th year. As a history book, it's horrendous. It skips a good portion of the important things that happened during that period of Persian history. What does it mention? Only those things that are pertinent to the miracle of Purim that teach us how to love and how to fear God because of that miracle. That's it. If it doesn't achieve that purpose, even though it's interesting, it's historical, it's not in Megillas Esther. That's for historians. That's for other books. It's not for the Torah. The Torah does not tell us information. It doesn't just tell us things. It tells us that which is necessary to teach us a lesson So we can learn how to live our lives in this world and for eternity, how to get closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And if it accomplishes that, it's there. And if it's there, it accomplishes that. And if it doesn't accomplish that, it's not there. Prove it to you. In last week's Sedra, there was a list of 10 generations between Adam and Noah. In this coming week's Sedra, there's another list of 10 generations between Noah and Avram. And the Avos Reb Nosson asked the same question. Asara doros mi Adam v'ad Noach, v'chi matzorech l'boy olam b'kach. Who cares? Why do I need the Torah to teach me a history lesson of 10 generations with names and dates? Who cares? For historians, that's very nice. It may be interesting, may be important, but it's not Torah. So the Mishnah answers and tells us why the Torah wrote it, to teach us two very important lessons, which I'll get to in a second. But you would expect that the account of these two 10-generation periods would be parallel, would be similar. Because it's the same God who wrote it, same author, same Torah. So if God wanted to tell us about one set of 10 generations and another set of 10 generations, he would have said it the same way. But it's not the same way. In last week's Sedra, the Torah spends 3 sentences discussing each generation. For instance, it says, Vayechi Sheis, so many and so many years, Vayolidus Enosh. Sheis lived so many years, and he had his main son, Enosh. Sheis then lived after that, so many and so many years, Vayolid Bonim Ubanos. He had more boys and girls. Vayechi Sheis, and Sheis lived a total of so many years, and he died. 3 sentences. How old he was when he had his main child, how old he lived after that and had other children, how old he was when he died. 3 bits of information about each generation. In this coming week, Sedra, we only have 2 sentences about every generation. Right? Vayechi Shem, so many and so many years, and he had Arpachshad. Shem lived after that, so many and so many years, and he had boys and girls. Finished with Shem, next generation. 1 sentence is missing. We only have 2 sentences for each generation. The 3rd sentence, how long they lived total, and they died, is missing. Doesn't even mention that these people died. It just says how old they were when they had their main child, how many years they lived after that and had other children. It doesn't say specifically that they died, and it doesn't give me the sum total of their years. You can figure it out. You know how old they were when they had their first child. You know how long they lived after that and had other children. Add the 2 together, you know how long they lived. But it doesn't say it in the Torah. In Noah. Only in Bereishis about the 1st 10 generations. Why? Why would the same Torah, same author, have 2 different styles of telling us about 2 sets of 10 generations? I think the answer is simple. What's the lesson? Like we said, the Torah would not have written this if it was only history. For historical information, it's not what's in the Torah. So the Torah wrote it because it wanted to teach us a lesson. It's Torah. What is the lesson? The 1st 10 generations, the Mishnah says, the lesson is to teach us how patient God is. With 2 emphases. How patient God is, and how patient God is. Meaning that all these 10 generations angered him, and yet he didn't bring the flood till after 10 generations. So we know that he's patient. We also know that his patience has a limit, and that after 10 generations, he destroyed them. So he waited 10 generations, but he didn't wait indefinitely. After 10 generations, they got their punishment. So we learn from that, love of God, God is patient, he doesn't punish immediately, and we learn fear of God, that eventually he does. So love and fear of God, we learn from that, from those 10 generations. Now, in order to know that lesson, okay, what information do you have to know to really digest that lesson? That these people were wicked, but they weren't punished. They lived a full, happy life, died in their beds normally. God didn't punish them until after 10 generations, then he brought the flood. I have to know they lived, that they had a lot of children, they lived a long time, and that they died. Because otherwise, maybe God struck them down with lightning bolts. So I have to know they lived 800, 900 years, and they died. They died. Once I see that over and over again, it sends the message home, teaches me that lesson, that God is merciful, patient, and his patience, though, has a limit. Okay. Now, what's the lesson of the second 10 generations? Why the Torah write the generations between Noah and Avram? For a different reason. Again, not for history, not to tell me history. It's to teach me a lesson. What was the lesson? That people can live and not fulfill their purpose and really not have a merit to exist. Somebody can come and influence them and do everything they were supposed to do and get the reward for all of them. Avram Avinu teaches me that one person can accomplish what millions of people don't do. Okay? And he can get the reward for all of them. He can save all of them and get the reward opposite all of them because he saved all of them. How much information do I have to know to learn that lesson? I have to know there were people and there were a lot of them. Do I have to know that they died? No. It's not relevant to that lesson at all. Do I have to know how old they were when they died? No, I don't have to know they died. I just have to know they lived, and there was a lot of them, and Avraham Avinu got the reward for all of them. And therefore, since to learn that lesson, I don't have to know how old these people were when they died, or even that they died, the Torah doesn't mention it. It leaves it out. Because it only mentions those things that I need to learn life lessons, right, to make me closer to the Rabbanu Shlom. It doesn't put information in that's only for the sake of information. No matter how interesting or important it may be, find it somewhere else, not here. So, therefore, the Torah is not a science book. It didn't come to teach us how many days God created the world and how old the world is. That's irrelevant to the Torah. The Torah came to teach me creation so we will know how to deal with the world. Not so we'll know how old the world is or how God created the world. Everything that's included in creation, in the narrative of creation, is there to teach me some lesson. How I can live my life better. And the fact that the world was created with 10 mamaros or in 6 days is to teach me that everything in the world is individually important. God didn't say, let there be a world. But each thing had a special creation, a special mimer. Every individual thing in the world is important, not just a general importance to the world. And that's why the word Bereshis, according to Chazal, does not signify time. God created a certain time. We're not concerned with the time that issue over here. Bereshis means Bishvil Yisrael Shenikroim Reshis, uVishvil HaTorah Shenikro Reshis. The Torah is concerned with teaching us the purpose of the world, not the fact of how the world got here. Or what's here? But what's it all about? What's it mean? That's what the Torah is concerned with. And therefore, Bereshis is the goal. What's the world created for? It's created for the Jewish people. It's created for the Torah. That's what the world is all about. That's what the Torah is concerned about. And therefore, the main idea that God created the world in 6 days, and that's what we review every Shabbos, not just when we read Sefer Bereshis, but every Shabbos we review that lesson. God created the world in 6 days, he rested on the seventh day, is not to tell me how he did it, not to tell me what he did, but tell me why he did it. What can I learn from that, right, that will make me closer to God, loving and fearing God, and make me a better person, and make me someone who can get the world to come. That's what it's all about. And how does that work? It works insofar. What does Shabbos teach me? Shabbos teaches me in a nutshell the following. Shabbos teaches me that God created the world. That's so very nice. That's for God's sake. Right? Now I know that God's powerful. He can create worlds. So now I respect him more. No. What it means that God created the world. Why is God concerned that we know he created the world? Not because he wants to covet, okay? Because of a different reason completely. Because then we know that we are bound to his design in how we live our lives in this world, since we are created beings. I always like to give the example. I don't know if I'm going to, maybe we will. Okay, it's Kedai. This lesson of this, the idea that what's so important that God created the world puts the Torah into perspective. You know, sometimes we think we keep the Torah because God's stronger. He could zap us with lightning bolts, so we better do what he wants us to do. We better eat what he wants us to eat and not eat what he doesn't want us to eat because, you know, he could punish us and he could reward us, so we better listen. But there's something much more fundamental to why we have to listen to the Torah. And I learned that from the following incident that occurred with me many years ago. When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, so I bought the first new car I ever bought in my life. I had rights, and there was no taxes, and there was a car that was assembled here in Eretz Yisrael at the time, a Ford Transit. So I had rights to buy that car for almost nothing. It was basically $8,000 for the car. And it's the only car that would fit my entire family. It was illegal, but it still fit my family, right? I could only really take two-thirds of my family legally, right? But Lamaisa, it fit them all. It was a Ford Transit, one of these vans, before vans became popular and everybody thought I was driving a truck. In any case, so, but then you couldn't buy a car on payments. You had to pay for it total up front in cash, okay? They wouldn't take a check either. So you had to pay for it in shekel. Now the old shekel at the time, this was about 21 years ago, the old shekel at that time was 1,000 shekel to a dollar. Okay? Yeah, not so long ago. 1,000 shekel to a dollar. Okay. The new shekel started and they made it 1 shekel to a dollar. So the new shekel is 1,000 times as big as the old shekel was. In any case, so, and the biggest bill they had at the time was a 100 shekel bill. They didn't have 200 shekel bills at the time. That's a new occurrence, 200 shekel bills. They only had 100 shekel bills. So I had to cash in $8,000, and I got it in 100 shekel bills, which filled a suitcase, because it was basically 8 million shekel in 100 shekel bills. Figure out how much that is. It's a lot. So I had a suitcase full of 100 shekel bills I was taking to the Ford Motor Company in Tel Aviv to buy my car. I felt like a drug dealer. So I carried this suitcase on the bus because I didn't have a car. So I went on the bus with this suitcase, right? I felt like handcuffing it to my arm. And I was hoping that it would not just pop open in the middle of the bus. And I put the suitcase down on the table, opened it up. The guy starts inspecting to make sure that, you know, it's all 100 shekel bills. And he says, okay, here's the keys to your car. Fine. So I ready to leave. He tells me where it's parked. It's yours. So I go to get the car, and he calls me back. He says, wait a second, I forgot something. So I was waiting for, I guess, another surprise, because buying a car here was totally a surprise. When I first went to pick out the car, so the guy says to me, do you want just the basic car or do you want the extras? So I figured extras is like a stereo, right? Maybe power windows or whatever, what other kind of extras they have in America. So I said, well, could you give me an idea of what extras there are? He says, like windows. I said, what do you mean windows? He said, well, we don't cut out the windows unless you buy it extra. So I said, yeah, I think I'll go for the extra windows. In any case, so I was prepared for anything. What did you forget? He said, I forgot to give you this. This is the owner's manual to the car. Big, thick book in Hebrew and in English that described for me what kind of gas to put in the gas tank, what kind of oil in the crankcase, what kind of detergent to use on the seats or whatever. I felt like telling this guy, what a chutzpah. I just gave you 8 million shekel in cold cash for this car, and you're going to tell me what to do with it? I'll do whatever I want with it. I'll put whatever I want in that gas tank. You're going to tell me what to put in the gas tank? Now, obviously, that was absurd because I didn't design the car. The Ford Motor Company designed the car. And unfortunately, they designed it to run on gasoline and not on water. Now, I could put water in the gas tank. It's my car. I could do whatever I want with that car. And I could put water in the gas tank, but it won't go anywhere. I could even put the wrong grade of gas in the gas tank, and it will go somewhere. But eventually, it'll burn out the motor. Similarly, God created the world. If I believe that God created the world, then God is the designer of the world. He designed me, and he designed the rest of the world. Then God is the only one who can tell me what I should eat. Because he created my system, physical and spiritual. He created the food, and he can tell me, look, this is what I designed you to eat. You're a Jew. You have this kind of neshama. This food is what should go into your system. Because if you eat this food, it's going to burn out your motor. You may go, but you're not going to get to where you want to end up. And this is what you should wear, and this is what you should speak, and this is what you should think. Not because God could zap us with a lightning bolt, because he designed us. And if I believe that he's the creator and he's the designer, then he is the only one who can tell me what I was designed to do, what I was designed to wear. And again, and I have a choice. I could put water in my gas tank too. But the car is not going to do what it's supposed to do. My neshama is not going to do what it's supposed to do if I wear the wrong clothing and I eat the wrong food and I whatever. So that is what puts the world into perspective, the fact that I know that God created the world. And every Shabbos, I reiterate that. And I remind myself that God is the designer of the world, and therefore I have to listen to him. Just like I have to listen to the Ford Motor Company, whether I like it or not. They're not going to zap me with a lightning bolt, but I'm going to ruin the car if I don't do what they tell me. If I use the wrong kind of detergent on the seat covers or on the plastic or whatever, it may destroy it. So that's one lesson that Shabbos teaches me. But that lesson could be learned if I kept Shabbos on Sunday. God started creating the world on Sunday. Celebrate Sunday that God created the world. But we don't celebrate Shabbos on Sunday. We celebrate on Shabbos. Why? Because that's when God finished creating the world. And if he finished creating the world, he must have started. But that's absurd. It's like roundabout. So why Friday? Because Friday or Shabbos, the end of creation, teaches me another lesson. God created the world, but maybe he didn't create it for any purpose. Maybe he said nothing to do one day, so he created the world. How do I know there was a purpose in the creation? The answer is because he stopped creating at some point. Then I know there's a purpose. How so? If you give a child blocks, and you tell him, what's it called, play with these blocks. When will he stop playing with the blocks? One of three possibilities. He gets bored and tired. So even if he hasn't used up all the blocks, he's going to stop. Or if he uses up all the blocks, even if he's not bored and tired, there's not any more blocks to play with. Or if he finishes what he planned to do. He wanted to build a building. He finished the building. Even though he has more blocks left, he's going to stop playing. He accomplished his purpose. The Rabbanu Shlom never gets tired, never gets bored, never runs out of blocks. So why would he stop creating? Only one reason. Because he had a purpose and he finished it. That means that the world has a purpose. So the fact that God stopped creating at some point means that he had a purpose in mind, and he reached that purpose, he stopped. So celebrating the end of creation teaches me that God created the world and he has a purpose for the world. But so why do we keep Shabbos, keep Friday? Because now we learn a third lesson, that purpose is not part of the system of the physical world itself, it's something beyond the physical world, it's Shabbos. It's a spiritual world that follows this physical world. The world was created by God. He created for a purpose, and the purpose is something eternal and spiritual. That's why we keep Shabbos. But it's interesting that the Christians celebrate Sunday as their Sabbath, because they believe also that God created the world. But they don't give too much importance to this physical world. This world is just a test. It's a place to try and avoid, stay away from, be celibate, live in a monastery, don't talk too much, don't wear nice clothing, give up all your possessions. That's the ideal. Most of them can't live like that, but that's the ideal. That's what they're, what's it called, holy people do, okay? Because this world is really not important at all. So they celebrate Sunday, which says that God created the world, but they don't celebrate the end of creation because they don't see that this physical creation has too much importance. So that day that they celebrate is perfect for them. The Muslims celebrate Friday, because they believe that God created the world, and they believe that this world is of utmost importance, because that's all there is. And the world to come is just a continuation of the physical things of this world. That's what their world to come is, physical things. So they celebrate Friday. The world was created, it was created for a purpose, and the purpose is this world. We celebrate Shabbos, which teaches all three lessons. God created the world, he created for a purpose, and the purpose is beyond the physical world. It's a spiritual world that comes after the 6 days of creation. Okay, in any case, it would be that even the whole Sefer of Bereishis would not have been mentioned. The fact that God created the world would not have been in the Torah. had it not been for the fact that God wanted to tell us we have a claim on Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara says the Torah should have started from the first mitzvah, not from Bereishis. Why did it start from Bereishis? Koach Ma'isav Higid Li'amo Losis L'Nachas Goyim. That is to teach us a lesson that gives us a claim to Eretz Yisrael. That in case, for argument's sake, theoretically, if the Goyim would ever say that we stole Eretz Yisrael from them, we conquered their land, right? That's a ridiculous thing. Nobody would ever say such a thing. But in any case, just in case somebody would say that, right? So we have an answer. What's the answer? Bereishis bara Elokim. God created the world. He gave it to you, took it away from you, gave it to us. So Goyim will claim that we are lishtim, we're ganodim. We have an answer. The obvious question is, the Goyim are going to accept that, right? When they come in the United Nations and claim that we stole this poor Palestinian land, right? So we're going to say, well, you know, it says in the Torah, Bereishis bara Elokim ha'shamayim v'ha'aretz. Right? And God gave us the land, and he took it away from the people who were here before, and you took it away, and we took it away from you. And then the Goyim are going to say, oh, we didn't know that. Right? Why don't you say that earlier? Right? We have no problem with that. Oh, if God gave you the land, you know, we have no problem. So, obviously, it's not for them, it's for us. We have to know we're not ganovim. But you know what it means? It doesn't just mean because it says in Bereishis that God promised the land to Avraham Avinu, that's why we're not robbers. We're not thieves. What it means is the following. The whole Bereishis, the whole idea of knowing that God created the world is to let us know it's not our world. We have nothing in this world. We are bound to the design of the designer. And if we eat and don't make a bracha and don't follow what God says, we're ganavim. We stole that food. We have no right to eat it unless we follow the dictates of the designer. It's God's world. He permitted us to use the world under condition. If we don't keep those conditions, we are stealing. Literally. We're ganavim in everything. And once it's clear that the Jewish people start their Torah with Bereishis, and we understand that it's God's world, and nothing that we do on our own. We do because God said we should do it. Then we're not ganavim in anything. Then we're not ganavim in Eretz Yisrael. And the Goyim can claim whatever they want. But if the Jewish people live in such a way that we do nothing in this world except at the dictate of God, then this is God's will. But if we think it's our world and we do what we want, then the Goyim have a claim. Then what are you talking about? God said. You do things that God doesn't say. It's your world. So it's our world too. We conquered it. It's ours. But there's no idea of taking. You don't take from this world. You're given by the Ribbono Shel Olam under certain conditions that everything we do and everything we have is done because that's God's dictate. If that's the case, Eretz Yisrael is no different. So if it's clear to the nations of the world, whether they like it or not, that we are a nation that live according to that philosophy, it's God's world, and we live in it according to his dictates, then if we took Eretz Yisrael from you, we didn't do it because we took it, because we're ganavim. We took it because God said we should take it, and it's his. He has a right to do that. And it's everything in the world. We don't eat because it's ours. We eat because God gave us permission. And he told us to take off trumas and maestras and to make a bracha and to wash our hands and whatever. And we do all of that. Because it's not ours. It's the Ribbono Shel Olam's. And we do it according to his dictates. In his framework. If that becomes clear from everything we do, then nobody has a claim that we took Eretz Yisrael. That's just part of our entire life philosophy. And the way that style of life, the lifestyle that we live. That's what it means. The Goyim will come, they may not accept it, but they don't have a piss on pair, they have nothing to say. Because look at the lifestyle that we live. We are not ganavim in anything. We live according to the dictates of God. If giving the Eretz Yisrael is the same thing. If we don't live according to that, then we have a hard time explaining why we're not ganavim. If we did it on our own, we wanted it, we thought, then we could become up. So the Torah gave us Bereishis to let us know whose world it is, under what circumstances we live and use the things in this world, and that applies also to Eretz Yisrael. Bottom line, the Torah is not a history book, Torah is not a science book, and therefore, how long it took God to create the world, could it take him a second, why did it take so long, or how could it be so short if it seems to be so long, all of that is interesting things to discuss. But it's not the purpose of the Torah. The purpose of the Torah is to teach me purpose, not science, not history, not the how or the what, but the why. Why is all this here? What are we supposed to do? That's what Torah is. Torah is Horah.